Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Coming up, Habermas and democracy.
Who is Jürgen Habermas?
One of the most influential philosophers in the world.
Habermas has done groundbreaking philosophical work in social political theory. Rational discourse is the foundation of democracy.
We are more divided than ever as a nation. Both sides are terrified of the other side. And I think that's why the voting booth has a curtain, so you have some place to hide after the election's over.
You think rational communication's easy? You think rational communication's natural? How is rational communication even possible?
How do the system and the life world interact to shape political consciousness?
What is the life world? What is the system?
Our guest is Matthew Spector, author of Habermas, an intellectual biography.
Habermas and Democracy, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hello, 89.3 FM. I'm the diva from WHFR's Lyrical Infusion, and I was wondering if I could get you to make a date with the diva. On Saturdays, 2 to 4 p.m., I'll bring the lyrical jazz, I'll bring the soulful R&B, and that funky neo-soul, I'll bring it with me. I throw back and I come new. The never heard before to the tried and true. So in the middle of your Saturday, I'll bring the lyrics out to play. Lyrical Infusion with the Diva, Saturdays 2 to 4 p.m. I tell you what, I'll meet you there.
Well, it's Sunday. Let's see. Morning paper? Check. Coffee perking? Check. Wait. Where's my jazz? Well, I got you, my friend. Hi, I'm Terrence. Your place for good jazz is on 89.3 FM from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. for the Play-By-Ear Jazz Show. We're making waves from Henry Ford College. Complete your Sunday trifecta with me. The Play-By-Ear Show, Sundays from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. right here on 89.3 WHFR.
Is rational argument the key to true democracy?
Can we design a public sphere in which reason can win out over power and propaganda?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, sitting in for John Perry, who's taking a well-deserved break.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on Stanford campus, where Ken and I teach philosophy.
And today, we're asking about the philosopher Jürgen Habermas and his stirring vision of democracy.
Habermas is famous for thinking that genuine democracy is grounded in the principles of communicative rationality.
Communicative rationality, Ray, that sounds like a mouthful. It sounds like a philosophy seminar, you know, with people sitting around calmly arguing back and forth. Everybody just searching for the truth. No ego, no power dynamics, no gender bias.
Look, it's more complicated than that, even in the philosophy seminar. But there's something to the analogy.
Okay, so enlighten me. What is there to this analogy?
Well, first let's think about the nature of communication, and then maybe we can see what that has to do with democracy. So let's start with the norms governing rational discourse.
Well, I like to think about that. Philosophers talk about the norm, say, of saying only things that you have good reason to believe.
Yeah, like that's a pretty basic one. And Habermas would say that if you violate it, you're not really engaging in rational communicative action at all.
Oh, wait. Not so fast. That seems too quick. I mean, suppose I'm a shyster. God, trying to get you to believe some BS. I mean, that may make me a crook, but does it make me irrational? Does it mean I'm not even communicating with you? That's what Habermas seems to suggest.
Well, if you are communicating, you're doing it dishonestly and manipulatively.
Okay, yeah, that's bad, I grant you, but is it irrational?
Well, the shyster may be perfectly rational in one sense, but not rational in another more important sense, like at least not according to Habermas.
I'm not sure I get this. What are you getting at?
So Habermas is distinguishing between instrumental rationality and communicative rationality. And instrumental rationality is just about adjusting means to ends. So you want to achieve some goal, and you believe that doing such and such would be an effective means to that goal. And if you're right, that would make it instrumentally rational to adopt those means.
Okay, but even a dishonest and manipulative shyster can be rational in that sense, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what are you saying, that instrumental rationality is like a bad thing or something?
No, it's a really important thing. It's just not the be-all and end-all of rationality. And it's certainly not enough to ground democracy.
Well, so wait a minute. This is where this highfalutin communicative rationality is supposed to come in, right?
Yeah. Think more about how real conversations work. Not sham conversations with snake oil merchants, but real conversations among people, all of whom are trying to get at the truth.
Oh, I know what you mean. You mean like here on Philosophy Talk, right?
Sure. Yeah, that's one example. Conversations that aim at the truth have their own internal dynamics. So when you make an assertion in that context, not only do you represent what you say is true, but you're going to hold yourself responsible for defending what you say if challenged.
Defending? That sounds a little combative or something.
No, not by the force of arms. By the force of the better reason.
Where better means what exactly?
More conducive to truth.
A truth is measured by whose lights exactly?
By our collective lights.
Oh, but what happens when we disagree, Ray?
Well, we'll just keep talking until we work it out.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I guess I get it. And I guess I see why Habermas wouldn't count snake oil merchants as communicatively rational. I mean, I guess he'd say they parade as communicatively rational, but that's just a sham, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because snake oil merchants aren't committed to the truth, and they're not committed to defending their views with valid arguments, and they're not content with the force of the better reason.
Okay, look, I'm going to grant you that this communicative rationality thing of Habermas is, it sounds really cool and all. But seriously, what's it got to do with democracy?
Well, for Habermas, democracy is actually this sprawling conversation where all the citizens in the conversation are equal participants, and they're all committed to not the force of arms or the power of propaganda, but to the force of the better reason.
Oh, come on. This is just a fantasy. In the real world, power does the talking, not reason.
Habermas is fully aware of the many ways in which power distorts communication, but to him that means we have work to do. So that we can define a public sphere where reason rather than power does the talking. Only then can genuine democracy thrive.
Oh, God. Good luck with that one.
Oh, come on, Ken. It can be done. And to help us think about how, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to examine some real-world attempts to make rational communication a reality. She files this report.
Jürgen Habermas may dream in democracy, but let's keep it real. Americans don't particularly have much faith in the democratic system right now, at least according to some polls, which people don't trust all that much anymore either. Propaganda got a new name this past election cycle.
It's now clear that so-called fake news can have real-world consequences.
He told officers he was there to investigate a fake news conspiracy that put the pizza restaurant at the center of a child sex abuse ring run by Hillary Clinton.
Can you stay categorical?
You are fake news.
Most people, most of the time, are not thinking about public policy issues in any depth, because why should they?
Stanford professor James Fishkin, a democracy expert, says the public has long been easy to manipulate.
They have their lives to lead. They are subject to what some social scientists have called rational ignorance. If I've got one vote in millions, why should I pay a lot of attention?
That's why, nearly 30 years ago, Fishkin decided to play around with democracy. He wanted to know, how would people's opinions change if they deliberated with strangers, consulted experts, and actually thought about issues that mattered? With this idea in mind, he came up with a method he called deliberative polling.
A deliberative poll is a poll of a population before and after it has had a chance to really think about an issue under good conditions.
In these experiments, Fishkin summons hundreds of people from the general population to see if they want to discuss important policy issues together. He held one deliberative polling session in California called What's Next, California?
Join us with What's Next, California?
Join us with What's Next, California?
What is next?
More than 400 Californians gathered in Los Angeles County to discuss statewide issues. And Fishkin says turnout rates for his sessions are surprisingly high because people feel like their opinions actually matter.
I came because I was lucky enough to be called.
I'm glad to see young people out here.
In the session, participants broke into small groups to discuss issues facing the state. Moderators are there to make sure no one dominates the conversation. One topic that proved super heated, raising taxes.
The real con argument to this, from what I understand, is that it doesn't cover all of the state spending. It only covers new spending.
No, it just doesn't address the existing spending.
It's just a fresh start.
It's just, yeah. I mean, that's a separate issue.
I want them to pay the same damn tax I'm paying. And that's it. Bam. Done. I'm done.
When deliberations in the sessions wrap up, Fishkin gives the participants another survey to see how their opinions change from start to finish. Often, he says, opinions do change. People are more empathetic than you might think.
The more advantaged sometimes have more to learn from the less advantaged. One of the groups I was listening to, this guy was a car thief. I mean, he said he was a reformed car thief, but, you know, he was a car thief. And he had a lot to say about why people commit crimes.
Many people also leave the deliberation room more interested in learning about the world. Once, a woman stopped and thanked Fishkin for making her husband think harder about political issues.
She said she wanted to thank me because in 30 years of marriage, her husband had never read a newspaper. But from the moment he was invited to come to this, he started to read newspapers every day. And he was going to be much more interesting to live with in retirement, which to me showed that we had created incentives to overcome rational ignorance.
So far, Fishkin has tried deliberative polling over 70 times in more than 24 countries. Thanks to Fishkin's help, Mongolia recently passed a law requiring the polling before the government makes any amendments to the constitution. So, the Mongolian government wants to know how well-informed people feel. But, Fishkin says, in the polarized United States, politicians are more concerned with their side winning. Which raises a key question behind our own democratic experiment.
Do we want a democracy when the people are thinking, or when they're not?
We won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated.
Perhaps we should all make like Habermas and start deliberating on that one. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McTeed.
Thanks for that amazing look at the deliberative democracy at work, Holly. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today, we're thinking about Habermas and democracy.
We're joined now by Matthew Spector. He's a professor of history at Central Connecticut State University and the author of Habermas, an intellectual biography. Matthew, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you, Rachel. It's good to be here.
Thank you for joining us, Matthew. Now, look, Matthew, you're a historian, and I may be confused, but, you know, I thought historians tend to focus on the past and on, well, you know, dead people. So what's a self-respecting historian like you doing studying a philosopher and one who's still alive at that?
That's a good question. When I first approached Habermas in writing and in person about this, he almost fell over with dismay when he heard my disciplinary affiliation. I first got interested in Habermas in college about 30 years ago. This was a time when we had another president with a tenuous connection to reality by the name of Ronald Reagan. And I was of a generation that was coming to political consciousness, critical of the U.S. government's policies in South Africa, siding with the apartheid regime, fearing Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress, and attacking the freely elected Sandinista government in Nicaragua. And I became a little bit critical of the official ideology of the United States, our professed commitments to support democracy, and my studies led me into Marx and Weber and the Frankfurt School, and that's how I found my way to Habermas. As a historian, my only excuse for poaching on philosophical territory is that I'm an intellectual historian, and so I'm constitutionally set up to do that kind of illegitimate turf spanning.
So it sounds like you find Habermas's vision really inspiring, and I can sort of see why, but given our current political situation, are you worried that it's too optimistic, and so optimistic that it's completely unrealistic?
Well, there are two things I'd like to say about that. The first is the question of translation of a German thinker and his reception in an American context. And it's important to remember that Habermas is a product of the post-war German situation. He's 16 in 1945. He's forcibly part of the Hitler Youth. And in a German context, you have a profound rationality deficit as well as democratic deficit. And so what may appear an overly idealistic emphasis on rationality, participation, the public sphere in the American context actually makes very good realistic sense in the German context, where those things desperately needed remediation.
So, Matthew, I want to ask you about the following thought then. I understand. So Habermas comes of age, political consciousness, full political and philosophical consciousness, coming out of the Nazi era and the attempt of German democracy to be born, right? And that's very his situation. But I don't think it's so irrelevant to our situation, because I think we're headed into not Nazism, but a context in which democracy threatens to break down. And I wonder what you think about that, but I'm going to ask you to hold your thought until after this short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about Habermas and democracy with Matthew Spector from Central Connecticut State University.
And in our next segment, we're going to take a closer look at Habermas's theory of communicative rationality. Can rational conversations really settle disagreement and disputes without power and coercion? And what do we do when asymmetries of power distort our discourse?
When reason talks and power walks, when Philosophy Talk continues. Want to think deep this holiday season? Become a subscriber and get access to 500 hours of philosophizing, anytime, anywhere.
Or help your friends and family think deep by getting them a gift subscription.
More information at our website, philosophytalk.org.
HFC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology includes detailed instruction related to the various systems found on today's vehicles. This program is designed to provide students with a thorough knowledge of the technical aspects of the automobile and to develop a certain level of manual skill in servicing, testing, and diagnosing. Classroom and laboratory classes provide students with the experience and understanding they'll need to qualify in numerous fields of employment associated with the automobile industry. For more information on HFC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology, contact Instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350. That's Instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
Henry Ford College's Mirror News is looking for new writers. The newspaper is student-run and a great opportunity for budding journalists to gain experience. The Mirror News covers a variety of topics such as politics, new restaurants, art exhibits, local events, and recent films. If you would like to share your talents, email Dr. Kim at pkim@hfcc.edu or the editor at editor@hfcc.edu. See yourself in the Mirror News.
25% of community college students report food insecurity and are going to bed hungry. Shocking, right? A friend sitting next to you in class could be going hungry and you'll never know. The good news? HFC is here to help. The Hawk's Nest has non-perishable food items available for students experiencing hunger. And you can help too. By donating non-perishable food items or money, you can be sure that 100% of your donation goes directly back into your college community. Donate today and fill a friend's plate. Go to hfcc.edu and search Hawk's Nest.
Working it out through rational deliberation, a vision of democracy from Jürgen Habermas. I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, sitting in for John Perry, and we're thinking about the political philosophy of Habermas. Our guest is Matthew Spector from Central Connecticut State University.
So, Matthew, I want to take you back to what we were talking about at the end as we were going out. So you talked about Habermas emerging in this distinctively German context and wondering that it might sound a little obvious or something or not gripping to Americans. But I actually think it should be gripping to Americans, because not that what the Germans emerge from, we're in danger of slipping into, but there is some danger of our slipping into a place in which the people and the state are distant and the civic order, the public sphere, as Habermas calls it, is debased and corrupt and dominated by bad influences. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, his early work was essentially showing the continuities between the fascist public sphere and the democratic public sphere, that far from being the ideal space of rational communication, which he thought was historically approximated in the Enlightenment coffee houses and salons, that the post-war public sphere was one in which moneyed interests, manipulated voters through irrational means, and this was the beginning of television and so on. And so he described this as a public sphere in a state of collapse. And so that certainly speaks to our moment and repays rereading.
So can you tell us more about what the public sphere should ideally look like for Habermas?
Yeah, well, what I wanted to say is that one of the misunderstandings, I think, your introduction was terrific. One of the misunderstandings I think that Habermas succumbs to is that his theory is actually quite humble and modest. And it's been criticized, if anything, it's been criticized as too thin or not prescriptive enough about the nature of the good society of social justice or redistribution. He does not see himself positing an ideal against which we measure the present as deficient. He actually believes he's explicating the existing normative core of our democracy. So the purpose of the theory is to elucidate already existing principles and logic of our practices.
So I want to slow you down a bit, Matthew. Can I, if I can slow you down just a little bit?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
Because
you said it was the thin, that he was articulating something kind of thin and not something very maximal. And but so I think that seems right to me. But I just want to focus.
That's his proceduralism.
On, right. Yeah. I just want to focus on what you mean by that. Because I mean, communicative rationality sounds kind of like a big deal. But in some ways, he doesn't mean it to be that big of a deal. It's people talking to one another about and not and without a manipulative and without just power dominating, but just like we talk to each other in a conversation about what we're going to do together. And somehow the structure of that conversation, if not distorted, is going to have some kind of good outcome. Is that right?
Well, I think... he is not sketching a concrete social utopia. He doesn't believe that we can actually expect the better argument to prevail, for people to converge on true or optimal outcomes. He doesn't have high expectations of people enlarging their perspectives, as we heard about in Fishkin's in the Roving Report. He doesn't. His vision of the public sphere doesn't depend on a robust concept of human nature as empathetic, as educable, as rational.
So wait a minute. So what does it depend on? It sounds now like a really anemic thing. You're making it sound like a weak read. So how do we get democracy out of that?
Well, essentially, what he's saying is that. I mean, he is a strong Democrat. He is not a rights foundationalist. He believes that that nothing is immune to democratic decision. Consensus is not the telos of all conversation, but he wants people to to deliberate and decide what the good society is on their own.
So I'm kind of worried now, because
yeah,
I'd like democratic deliberation to end in a sort of reasonably good decision. Otherwise,
yep.
What's the point of it? So if you just have a bunch of people who don't know what they're talking about, all agreeing to do something,
yep.
but they agree to do the wrong thing, why bother with a democracy?
Well, it's a very he is not an epistemic Democrat. He's not saying deliberation produces more rational outcomes, better outcomes. It's really grounded in a Kantian idea of autonomy, that it is essential to our freedom that we be both – that we be the authors of the laws of which we are the addressees.
Even if they lead us to ruin. I mean, Kant thought that, you know, the legislative power of rationality was going to keep us from doing evil, keep us from going bad. It was the embodiment of the moral law, right? So this is morality operating. It sounds to me like you're saying, well, I'm not quite sure what you're saying. You sound to me like he has a kind of Kantianism, but without this Kantian belief that if you just reason rightly, right, if you're
yep.
just subject to the constraints of rationality, you're going to get the morally good outcome, because that's what rationality does. It commands the will and prohibits mm-hmm. evil and all that stuff. So does Habermas have or not have these Kantian inclinations in that way?
Well, I mean, for him, what remains of reason in what he calls a post-metaphysical world is discourse. And discourse is the practice of raising validity claims, of testing and critiquing them. And discourse presupposes a general normative demand or expectation for rational acceptability. This isn't the same as saying that all discourse is rational, or that all discourse tends to rational outcomes, or that discourse civilizes the savage by teaching him to reason. Rather, he's saying that there is a normative expectation raised by the very structure of human language that we can seek and obtain understanding without coercion. And this is sort of his standpoint by which he measures the freedom of a society.
Right. Okay.
Right? Well, he's reconceptualizing what the emancipated society is, and using that as a benchmark for critique.
So can I try and say what I think the idea is, and let me know if I've got this right. So even if my fellow citizens make terrible decisions, it's really disrespectful to take the decisions away from them because the decisions are sort of theirs. So you don't get to decide, you know, what I eat, even if I'm eating badly, because I'm an autonomous human being. And maybe you don't get to decide how my society is run, even if I make bad decisions about how my society is run, because that's not treating me with respect, the respect that's due to.
But I do get to argue with you. I do get to argue with you about your choices. Right,
right? But that is communicative rationality. Right. So it doesn't always arrive at the right decision.
Yeah, I mean, you could have the very bad and unjust outcomes generated democratically, and you would have to submit them to these would be validity claims raised in speech. If you can raise those claims in a recognizably rational way, they can be contested, they can be debated. And now, will the more rational, more just outcome prevail? No, there are no guarantees.
Okay,
and I'll just add one last thing, which is that his practice is very different than his theory, because in the practice of his life as a public intellectual, he is a hyperpartisan. And I think he's created a neutral, sort of anemic, bloodless procedural system in which he expects people to be very passionate and fighting for their visions of the good.
I'd love to have you folks out there join this conversation. We're talking about Habermas's vision of democracy with Matthew Spector. But I want to ask you, Matthew, I'm a big fan of democracy, but this Habermasian defense is making me think, well, really? Because Plato, you know, thought democracy was the second worst form of government. He didn't really have a deep analysis of the sort that Habermas offers of communicative rationality, but he did have a deep analysis of rationality, right, and the good and how reason can direct you to the good. And if you let just 1,000 voices speak and count every voice as an equal weight, some voices matter more than others, and you should be moved. He believed, like Habermas, you should be moved by the force of the better reason. But the voice of the better reason wasn't necessarily, you know, resident in everybody equally. So what about that? That, you know, some people are fit to speak the voice of the better reason, and some people aren't.
Well, like I said, I don't think he has an idealized view of what a speaker needs to bring to the table to be a fit participant in public discourse. And so in that sense, it doesn't have, you know, some of the baggage of, you know, a John Stuart Mill or, you know, certain other models.
Wait a minute. Is that a feature or a bug? I mean, Platonist says, we don't let every speaker at this table because not every speaker speaks with the authority of the better reason. We let at this table those who speak. Now, I'm not quite sure if you're saying those Platonic constraints and who gets to speak are illegitimate, or that Habermas has a version of that too. Which are you? I'm not quite sure.
Well, he's a strong anti-elitist. He's a strong Democrat in the small d sense, and he believes that the truth will out, you know, through the public contestation and the raising of validity claims in rational form, and he demands that we do that. I mean, it's not simply the rule of the strong. It's saying that if we're going to democratically coerce each other to do things by the law, that coercion must be legitimated by the strongest possible means, which is rationality and the public use of reason.
So this makes me wonder about experts. So in some domains, I sort of would have thought, just from my current perspective, that it's okay to have experts make the rules for me. So like food and drug legislation, I don't know anything about that. So what exactly is the scope of decisions that require democratic participation instead of expertise?
Well, I mean, Habermas's critique of technocracy is a leitmotif of his whole career. You know, in the current situation, his critique of the European Union is that it is ruled by technocratic experts that are not sufficiently legitimated by democratic decisions. So I would say that, another kind of expertise of which he's skeptical is judicial expertise. The generation that created the democracy in West Germany in 1949 was so suspicious of democracy that they put a great deal of power in the Supreme Court and in judges to, because you don't trust majorities, right? Yeah. You want to have, and you have a strong Bill of Rights in the Basic Law. And ironically, despite Habermas's exposure to the dangers of democracy, he still wants to go for it, and he's still more concerned about paternalism, elitism, technocracy, expertocracy, than the reverse.
Matthew, that's really cool. We got a caller. I'm going to let this caller in. Todd in Palo Alto's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Todd. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm curious with how Habermas deals with lobbyists or people with an agenda. I mean, are those relegated? I mean, that seems to me how our democracy is shaped. We have people with agendas. You know, you have the oil companies on one side and the environmentalists on the other side, and they're all trying to get their agenda to become reality.
Good question.
How does Habermas deal with people with an agenda that would preclude them from participating in rational discourse because, they're only trying to get their agenda accomplished?
Excellent question, Todd. Thank you so much for the call. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, Habermas has seen that kind of interest group lobbying his entire life. He understands it's not going anywhere. And what he would say is that, he's not saying we're going to turn this game of rugby into some kind of ballet. We're going to let these people do what they're doing. But undistorted political communication is a public good. It's like public land. It needs to be protected. It needs to be subsidized.
But let me ask you a
something
question.
Something like Citizens United would be, an illegitimate intrusion of money at distorting, giving unequal power to someone's speech over another.
That's going to lead to our final segment. But I want to ask you a really quick question before we get to the break. I mean, really quickly. I mean, but how do I distinguish the mm-hmm. legitimate participant in rational conversation moved by the force of the better reason from somebody with a mere agenda? I mean, how do I go about distinguishing that person from another person, who's just like talking to me? Because that's what the lobbyist would claim for himself.
Right. Well, like I said, I don't think there's anything in Habermas' system to say, a priori that person doesn't get to use their, to instrumentally seek their ends. That person is allowed to participate, and if they're making empirically falsifiable claims about denying climate change or something like this, then that speech is going to be confronted with it's going to be contested.
Yeah. Okay. We'll take this up more after a break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about Habermas and Democracy with Matthew Spector, author of Habermas, An Intellectual Biography.
In our final segment, we'll think about how to redesign our political, economic, and social systems to make them live up to Habermas's stirring vision. Are these changes achievable? Are they desirable?
Achieving Democracy, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Want to think deep this holiday season? Become a subscriber and get access to nearly 500 hours of philosophizing, anytime, anywhere.
Or help your friends and family think deep by getting them a gift subscription.
More information at our website, philosophytalk.org.
Music is a bridge between the material and the spiritual. My name is Harvey Lauer, and I'm 82. As a blind person, you have to be aware that nobody can tell you what you can or can't do. You really have to try things. My folks got me a little radio in 1940, and that was the best Christmas present I ever got. When I was 11 years old is when I started to play music, play the piano, and then the accordion, and then the cello. My wife, who was also blind, was a good cook. When she died, that's when I started Meals on Wheels. America, let's do lunch.
It's Meals on Wheels.
One in
six seniors faces the threat of hunger, and millions more live in isolation. Drop off a hot meal and say a quick hello. Volunteer for Meals on Wheels by donating your lunch break at AmericaLet'sDoLunch.org. This message brought to you by Meals on Wheels America and the Ad Council.
When I was little, I didn't talk for a long time. I liked things to always be the same. Anything new or different would scare and upset me. I was very sensitive to lights and sounds. It was almost like I had bigger eyes and ears than everyone else. So I built secret hiding places where nothing could get in. I didn't like looking people in the eye. It made me feel uncomfortable. I'd throw big tantrums over little things, like when my socks didn't match. Sometimes I'd do the same things over and over. Until one day, I found out I had autism. My family got me help. Slowly, I learned how to live with it better.
You can see signs of autism in children as young as 18 months. Early intervention can make a lifetime of difference. Learn the signs at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Could talking things over more get us closer to true democracy? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, sitting in for John Perry. Our guest is Matthew Spector from Central Connecticut State University. And we're thinking about the political philosopher Jürgen Habermas.
And we've got a caller on the line, Philip from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philip. What's your comment or question?
Thank you very much. Matthew, I really like this discussion, and my interest is in equitability. And I say this with respect to just a general equation. Let's say there are 10 people in your democracy, 6 have nothing and 4 have something. It makes sense for the six people to vote for the 4 people to give them something at no cost. And here's where the equation breaks down. Is that how do you make sure that in a democracy that it's equitable to those who may have had the opportunity to get something through work, and others have not had that opportunity and expect redistribution without value exchange? So the question is, how do you get value exchanged in a democracy?
Excellent question, Philip. What do you think, Matthew? I don't know if he's asking you or is he asking you to channel Habermas. Do whichever you wish.
I'm not sure I understand the question, actually.
Well, I think he's thinking, so look, there's all these inequalities between people, right?
Yep.
You can't just have, and you could say, well, forget about the inequalities. Let's just talk as equal participants in the rational conversation. But wait a minute. The inequalities distort conversational roles, don't they?
Okay.
So, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think.
And so don't we have to do something about the inequalities first in order for the conversational roles not to be distorted?
Absolutely, and that fits well with the theme of the segment, which is, you know, what kinds of reforms does the public sphere need? And, you know, for Habermas, there's no liberalism without democracy. Liberalism or system of rights without democracy is incomplete. Similarly, he would say there's really no political democracy without socialism or social solidarity. And, you know, one of the problems in his system is his proceduralism doesn't necessarily get you to social democracy, but the effectiveness of the public sphere depends on enough material equality for people to participate.
So now I'm worried.
It implies a standard, you know, some social provision, and that fits with his political profile as, you know, social democrat his whole life and so on.
So now I'm worried though, because so in the previous segment you told us that Habermas's theory isn't very idealistic. It's sort of meant for real people. But I'm wondering, what do you do in a situation where you don't even have enough social equality to get democratic deliberation up and running, where it looks like you've neither got an ideal nor you've got a realistic system that anybody could actually use in sort of circumstances of inequality? Like, where is the middle ground?
I think he's realistic about that deprivation, you know, incapacitating the public sphere or making it not less than what reason demands, right? Less than universal.
Wait a minute. What does reason demands? What does reason? I thought what reason demands in the Habermasian story. I may be confused about this.
Yeah,
there's like instrumental rationality. You know, I've got an end. And there's some means to the ends, rational, communicative rationality. What reason demands is that I justify myself to the other, that the other justify himself or herself to me, that we talk, that we be committed to adjudicating these validity claims by shared standards. The outcome of it, though, that can't really be anticipated, right?
That can't
be anticipated in advance. So what does reason demand other than we'll talk? I mean, what does reason demand? Anything substantive?
Well, what I'm saying is, for the ideal validity testing, you know, rational public discussion to occur, you want to have all. It's a version of the all affected principle,
right?
All those who are affected, or those who are going to be addressees of the laws that come out of the system, need to be in some way enfranchised to be authors of those laws.
Okay, so let's slow down there too, because I don't know if this answer is Ray or not. I'm just not sure. So if you think about the conditions necessary to make this kind of conversation happen, a lot of stuff is going to have to be built into the build. And otherwise, this conversation can't take place. So there's got to be not just an ideal of equality, but real equality. You say he doesn't believe in sort of intrinsic rights, but sort of communicative rights have to be secured. Now, that's a lot. That turns out to be a lot of stuff, right?
Yes, I agree with you.
So that sounds still pretty demanding.
One thing he does see the internet as having revived a kind of submerged phenomenon of an egalitarian public sphere, and that counterbalances the traditional weaknesses of mass communications, which are more asymmetrical and passive. He sees some progress in the advent of the internet because of the way it increases access.
Right. So should we be worried about net neutrality then? Like from
absolutely.
A Habermasian perspective.
Absolutely. I think all of these the preserving net neutrality is very important.
So I'm going to ask you a different kind of question.
Yep.
This rationality thing of Habermas is this communicative rationality. I don't communicate with myself, right? I communicate with the world, right? So it seems like it's got this intrinsically social thing.
Yes.
But the question, well, I wonder about, and he seems to have a kind of, at least pressure toward a kind of universality. So, but suppose I just got me and my tribe, and I communicate within my tribe and the other tribe are incommensurable, as Kuhn used to say. We can't dialectically engage with one another. Is there anything in Habermas to stop the world from fracturing, you know, communicative rationality going to stop the world from fracturing into closed off tribes that talk within themselves but don't talk across boundaries?
That's a good question. I think he believes in the unity of reason and that there is one world. He wouldn't accept the premise of incommensurable life worlds. He thinks that that rationality transcends, and not everyone agrees on the good life, but that norms are potentially universalizable.
So potentially universalizable. So what happens, yeah, though, if I engage in what looks like communicatively rational behavior with the people who sort of share interests with me, but then there's some other group where I treat them like they're instrumentally useful to me. And so am I being rational? Am I being partly rational? Am I being no-wise rational because I'm not paying attention to everybody affected by my decisions?
If I treat someone not as an end in themselves, I think that would not pass muster.
Well, let me press that concern another way, because I'm trying to figure out how much of a dreamer and how much of a realist Habermas is. I mean, there's the great globalizing cosmopolitan force, I would guess, of Habermasian communicative rationality. And then there's this other thing in the world. I don't know exactly where it comes from, but it's there and it's always present. It's always been present. I'm just going to call it tribalism or localism. And I mean, I don't know where history is going, whether the world's going to fracture into warring tribes or... But there seems to be some underlying belief that just being communicatively rational, we're going to overcome tribalism. How's that supposed to work? I mean, isn't Donald Trump like proof against that? Isn't Al-Qaeda and ISIS, aren't they proof against that?
I mean, I guess, you know, this is the question of whether there's like a philosophy of history sort of smuggled in, you know, kind of crypto level. I mean, his analysis of Brexit and Trump, I mean, he actually does see that as a kind of cunning of reason. Like he actually sees those phenomenon as symptomatic of the legitimation crisis of European and American democracies. So essentially, if democracy had been more like I wanted it to be, you would not have these symptomatic expression. So it's not a regression which falsifies the theory, but a regression which supports the theory, if you will.
So can I just check that I understand what you're saying here?
But in terms of fragmentation into tribalism on a global scale, I have to think about that a bit more.
Right. So I want to make sure that I've understood what you're saying. So, So Brexit and Trump is the Habermasian. So this looks like a problem because it looks like democracy has given us these decisions that don't take everybody's interests into account, that only take into account an interest of like a tiny segment of the population who are kind of xenophobic and horrible in other ways. And so one thing you might think is, look, this is a problem for Habermas because it was democratic deliberation that got you there. But I think what you're saying is there was something wrong with the deliberation that got you there. So that's why it's not a problem for the theory, because it wasn't really democratic. There was a problem that made it not actually an exercise of communicative reason. So is that what you're saying?
No, I don't think that properly constituted communicative reason always leads to just and inclusive outcomes. I think what I'm saying is that he sees a kind of reason in the irrationalism, in the hatred, in the intolerance. He sees a kind of distorted testimony to a real problem, which is the unresponsiveness of contemporary democracies to their citizens' real needs. Right. So whether And I mean, and this is how I understand Trump as well, right? I mean, you know, you don't want to demonize every Trump voter as a racist, though there is a great deal of racism and xenophobia and intolerance and misogyny, and the whole list goes on. Some of it is, you know, deflected or displaced sense of, you know, social exclusion or economic. Economic exclusion, right? And so I think that, you know, one of the things we've seen in the resistance to Trump and in, you know, recent public discourse is a very strong American rearticulation of these Habermasian ideas that constitutional values really matter, that participation in the public sphere really matters. Habermas talks about learning by disaster, and in a way, you know, he does have this faith that things will progress, and he can't really ground that faith.
So unfortunately, Matthew, we're out of time.
Yeah, Matthew, you were just getting to some really interesting stuff, but you know, the demands of radio. So I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. Okay.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Our guest has been Matthew Spector. He's a professor of history at Central Connecticut State University. He's author of Habermas, an Intellectual Biography. Now, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, get this, cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community. And please do by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, let's hear from our democracy's fastest rational communicator. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, democracy is constantly in danger, so I read, but I'm not sure we ever had it, except very locally, as in, who wants dessert? And we all raise our hands, and a brave new world has not been gainsaid. Before the public sphere, we had kings, before whom the public merely spectated, kind of like President Trump and his cabinet. We rendered the small gifts of adoration. In return, we got to keep most of our swine, and surviving children got to make charcoal from the bones of invaders. It was a hard life, but the emperor dressed well. Of course, there were flaws in the public sphere. It was bourgeois, consisting of people who could afford to go to coffee houses, who owned land, who were men, who were white, yada, yada, yada. Beyond the world wars, we are starting to reap the consequences of all that now. The full non-intersectionality of cis-gen race privilege is unraveling, and capitalism continues its downward spiral. Uber and Airbnb indicate not only that we can't afford to live in our homes or drive our own cars, we don't even have jobs anymore, just gigs, unless we're musicians, in which case we give away music for free and starve bravely. Once one can make a living being a sanctioned authority disruptor, but painting, music, movies, theater, books, poetry, they're either wasting away or bloated beyond recognition. There's no more mainstream outside of a few outliers like Hamilton and its variations and stuff we've been seeing for the past 40 years. Star Wars, more Star Wars, something that looks like Star Wars. Same old opera, same old symphonies. The mainstream is a sludgy trickle. But there didn't used to be streams at all, just places where things happen, like Broadway, New York, Paris, Hollywood, London. And that would trickle down to the rest of the world. That's going, gone, thanks to the Internet, which was supposed to become the great ultimate public sphere. Didn't work out. Now, sure, pretty much every piece of music ever recorded is at our ear tips. More books we can read in 1,000 lifetimes. All of human knowledge there with a poke and a swipe of a finger, but we're getting dumber, not smarter, less educated, not more. Anti-evolution, anti-science, everything's a trick. It's all a conspiracy. We're argumentative, suspicious, stubborn, deadlocked. And on a collision course with potentially ecological oblivion, even as the obvious but tough choices stare us right in the face. Why is that? The expanding functions of science and technology and globalism undermine labor. Plus, we are exhausted by movements. Neoliberalism, libertarianism, neo-Straussian, Foucault-denying, crypto-normative utopians. We're done with all that. We instead opt for pictures of kittens, or President Trump acting boorish, or Hillary Clinton falling over. Innovation is not only taking us out of the workforce picture, it's converging our role as citizens with our roles as consumers and spectators. We've seen stuff. We know what we want. We know what we like. We choose online. Computer knows what we like, and we like that very much. Computer talks to us and tells us what we want based on what we tell computer. Originally, the Internet brought together weirdos, geeks, nerds, lint collectors, left-handed communists, transsexual bodybuilders. We formed chat groups, created forums, blogs, websites, Facebook pages. Before we knew it, we weren't alone anymore. But now the Internet is another enabler of bubbles. The algorithms in stereo of your bubble, it makes the bubble more resistant. We don't always get what we want, but we get what we want to hear. So-called fake news is bland heroin, addictive, but just a little bit, entertaining, but just a little bit. It's an excess of moderation. Back before the Internet, public access television was going to change everything. Video was going to be the great equalizer, like MTV, only politics. Same thing now. We all have cameras. We have a yearning to expose the hidden, the secret, the elite. Well, not. We're making selfies, not usies or themies. The Internet fooled us into thinking we're all part of it. The Internet lied. We are servants of a new king. Starring our own little movies, offering the glittering gift of our ever shorter attention span, we worship our own naked mindfulness. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Audrey Dilling, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Where do you stand politically?
What can I say to that? I'm for total, honest democracy, you know, and I also believe the American system can work.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Guys and dolls, you are at the Malt Shop with Daddy G here in WGFR, and we are going back to the 50s and the 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the Malt Shop, where the jukebox is playing.